Riley Herbst from 2311 Racing here, and you know what grinds my gears? Waiting for coffee. But instead of counting frappes and lattes, I fire up Chumba Casino. No apps, no fuss, just fun social casino games to pass the time. By the time my coffee's ready,
order for Riley.
I've already taken a few victory laps. Next time you're stuck waiting, make it entertaining. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
In 2017 in Toronto, a Canadian billionaire and his wife were found dead in their multi-million dollar mansion. Whilst police initially suspected a murder-suicide, private investigators concluded that they'd both been victims of a double homicide. And what followed would prove to be the highest profile murder investigation in Toronto's history, uncovering questionable business practices, family feuds, and rumours of a professional hit. Yet, 5 years on, the killer remains at large. This is what happens when a monumental rise to the top makes powerful enemies. This is the murder of Barry and Honey Sherman. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. I wanted to cover today's case because it's unsolved and because there is also an enormous reward for actually presenting information that could essentially bring to light the killers of this poor couple. It's a really intriguing case with lots of twists and turns, and hopefully by the end of it, you will have your own ideas about who you think could be responsible for this. I know that I certainly do. Let's go back to 2017. So it's still a relatively recent case. We've got 75-year-old Bernard Charles Sherman. Now, he's better known as Barry, and he's literally one of the richest men in Canada. So he's the 12th richest man. So a very notable individual of great worth. And he had a huge amount of money. The estimated net worth was $4.6 billion. But I would say that his reputation was kind of a bit Marmite. So you'd either love him or hate him. There was a certain level of questionability when it came down to people's perceptions of Barry. Many viewed him as a really intelligent, incredibly fiercely loyal friend, skilled businessman. He was quite a devoted husband from what I can understand. So all of those particular traits seem to ring true. But I'd say he was also hated by quite a few people. And there were different reasons for that. And I use the word hate because we're not necessarily just thinking about hate in the emotional level of I have had a situation with you and now I hate you. We're talking about the reputation of an individual that becomes a particular thing and that people then show hatred towards that particular reputation. It's not even necessarily absolutely reflective of the person they are. It's the idea of who they are, if that makes sense. So in 1974, he's bought his late uncle's collection of pharmaceutical and chemical businesses. This was known as Empire Companies. And from doing that, he builds a new pharma corporation, Apotex Inc. Now, anybody who has been alive in the past few years as a young adult onwards is going to be highly aware of just how lucrative the pharmaceutical business is, and actually just how corrupt and just how dangerous it is as well. So all of these things are very true, and he's involved in this particular type of business. Obviously, in the 70s, it isn't what it is like now, genuinely. I think we all know that there are quite a lot of megalomaniacs running those kind of companies. But back in the 70s, I'm sure it was lucrative, but in no way, shape or form, anything like comparable to today. So he builds Apotex Inc. He's CEO, he's chairman, and he starts off really small. So he's only got two staff. But by 2017, he's got a global workforce of 11,000. Now, that is a hugely successful business. And you cannot underestimate an individual who starts off with two staff and ends up like this. It's kind of the Amazon thing, isn't it? Where an individual begins selling books in a warehouse, packaging them themselves, and then all of a sudden, they're like the richest people in the world. It takes a great deal of work. So this particular company specialized in the creation and sale of generic pharmaceutical drugs. Now, a generic pharmaceutical drug is a drug that contains exactly the same chemical substances as the brand name drugs, But the brand name drugs obviously are protected by chemical patents. So when you go to the shops and you don't just buy the Tesco, Asda or whatever supermarket local to you brand version is, you will know that there is a more expensive drug that's sold side by side that is a name that you know. And so the named big brands, they have a period of time, a period of grace where only they are meant to be able to sell the chemical components within those drugs. But there is a point where the patent expires. And at that point, obviously, it's open season for other companies. And what happens then is that other companies do produce cheaper generic versions of the drug. And that makes it a far more competitive market. Now, what I would say about Barry, he didn't get the memo on that. So even though this is the way it's meant to work, that somebody creates a drug and they sell it usually at a high level of profit because they're the only people dealing with it, particularly when it's a really effective medication, they're obviously going to be able to sell it at a premium. And we've seen that particularly in America, where, shall we say, horrific corrupt charlatans to some degree have taken over particular drugs and then increased that drug price by maybe 2,000-3,000%. It's very unscrupulous. But genuinely, this is what happens. They become the market holders for a period of time. Barry doesn't operate in that way. So even though this is how it's meant to work, and to be fair, the way he operates makes him incredibly unpopular in this big business, cutthroat world of giant pharmaceuticals, what he does is he basically exploits Canadian laws, and they're the laws that apply to chemical patents. So instead of waiting for the patent to actually expire, he just goes right ahead and produces and markets the generic versions of the protected drugs whilst the patents are still in force. So essentially, he's usurping the opportunity for those big pharmaceutical companies with those particular products to profit in the way that they used to, because he's undercutting them. Now, understandably and very predictably, the patent owners are not happy with this. They're like, Barry, it's our drugs. Why are you literally stealing our opportunity for grossing out on this particular profit that we feel we deserve? And they start taking legal action against him. But legal action for any of us, we're all aware, there are two main things associated with that. First of all, they take a very long time. They're very protracted. And also, they are really costly. And I guess for Barry, it's a risks reward scenario, because he's continuing to just sell those generic versions and he's making himself a very rich man in the process. Because if you have a certain amount of money to spend on medications for your organization and somebody comes in and undercuts a very expensive competitor, you're going to go with the person who undercuts them. There is not a lot of loyalty in business, and I think in the pharmaceutical world, where any loyalty and any kind of compassionate empathy towards anybody else left the building, I don't know, at least 2 decades ago. So on one level, what we could say is that Barry is making himself a very rich man in the process, but also he will be making a huge amount of enemies. And these aren't enemies who are short of a bob or two. These are enemies with means. And you don't get people meaner than in the pharmaceutical business. Now, when he gets questioned about the business activities, because obviously people want to know, why are you not sticking to protocol? What is it about you that means that you decide that you can just undercut these individuals, essentially steal the information that should be protected by a patent and just go out there and undercut these individuals? Now, he described himself as a Robin Hood type of character, which I kind of connect with, because that is to some degree what he's doing. He offers cheaper versions of big brand names to the public. So effectively, in his mind, he's taking from the rich and giving to the poor. A lot of people disagreed with that analogy. I bet those running the actual pharmaceutical corps or the individuals who got the original patents were certainly disagreeing with that analogy, because I guess they do have a level of point. So he does sell the drugs cheaper than the actual brand name version. So that is absolutely true. But Canada still paid more considerably for those generic drugs that he sold than other countries typically did. So even though he is doing a good deed on one level, he's still making a huge amount of money. It's certainly not a pro bono scenario where he's just making everybody well through his drugs and not worrying about the profit. And Barry knew this. He was somebody who was under absolutely no illusion. He knew that people thought his business model was questionable. He knew that it made him unpopular with other pharmaceutical companies. And he was even known to joke that he genuinely couldn't understand why pharmaceutical companies just didn't pay to have him killed. He actually said it would be quicker and cheaper because obviously the dragging through the courts where litigation is concerned, it's going to be very costly. It's taken a lot of time. And obviously just sending somebody out to do a hit on him would be way quicker to deal with the issue. Now, given his really relatively unpopular reputation amongst certain areas, shall we say, within the corporate world, without a doubt, it is kind of surprising that he didn't choose to have 24/7 bodyguards and security. This guy was rich, richer than probably any of us could ever imagine, and he could definitely have afforded it. But there is another trait that Barry seems to have, and that is he is relatively frugal. So he's very wealthy and he has a lot of money, but he doesn't necessarily enjoy spending it that much. So he's not somebody who flaunts his wealth. I'd even go as far as saying he's not somebody who necessarily really enjoys the trappings of it. So even though he's making a lot of money, I don't think the materialism was quite as high level as the Jeff Bezoses of this world, who literally have to deconstruct an incredibly massive, beautiful bridge just to get their super yacht through it because it's too big. We're not talking about the Bezos complex here. And also, I guess that makes you question, well, is it all about profit for him? Because arguably, he's not being as flashy as he could be. And therefore, can it play back into that idea that this is a guy that, yeah, wants to make money, but he wants to make money at a cost to the pharmaceutical companies who he believes are really playing the public by making them pay too much for drugs that they shouldn't have to pay that price for. So for example, when you look at his property, you know, realistically, compared to other billionaires, he lives in a pretty modest property. So it's a mansion, don't get me wrong. It's not like it's something comparable to my home, and I know that I'd have traded mine if he wanted a more humble abode. But basically, it's a mansion in Toronto's North York neighbourhood. They'd lived there from 1991, so obviously they're not individuals, in spite of their wealth accruing, who also feel the need to accrue stuff at that moment in time. They've been there a long time. The actual value of that property was in the region of about $7 million. Also, he was known for driving really battered cars. And on his birthday, when he was 50, Honey, who's clearly a devoted and loving wife, she'd actually bought him a sports car and there was a massive bow around it. And you can imagine that most men would be like, honey, that's a really good present that you've got me. But Barry wasn't like that. Barry was like, nope, not impressed with that. You've been out, you've bought a sports car. Just because I'm driving around in these old battered motors does not mean they don't get me from A to B. And literally in front of the party guests, he said that she needed to return it. Honestly, not gonna lie, if my husband had done that to me, my husband would have been returning it to the shop himself and probably had have his bags packed at the same time, because don't humiliate me in front of an audience, particularly when we're worth billions of pounds. But she actually does return it. And I guess that shows a level of respect towards him. She's probably used to him as well. At the end of the day, even though she probably wanted him to really enjoy that present, she probably in the back of her mind thought this could go sideways, and it did. Now his son, Jonathan, he'd later describe his father as brilliant, but he also said that
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply. In spite of that brilliance, and clearly this is a guy who's incredibly successful, we cannot underestimate the amount of work ethic this kind of person has, but he said he also lacked emotional and social intelligence, as just demonstrated in what I've just described about that birthday, that's not an emotionally intelligent response. A lot of you guys and girls who have female partners out there, you'll be thinking, yeah, it's not emotionally intelligent to tell a woman you're returning the gift. There can be dire consequences for those actions. Now, Barry's wife, oh, she sounds just absolutely delightful, genuinely. She was kind of described as the exact opposite to Barry. So Honey Sherman had actually been born in a Polish concentration camp to Jewish Holocaust survivors. So I cannot imagine a more traumatic start to life. And I cannot imagine a more grounding experience on reflection. To know that your parents survived, that they managed to literally get through probably one of the most treacherous times in our recent history, and to have literally been born into it, I think that probably, aside from creating resilience and thanks and gratitude because she lived and her parents lived, there's also that sense of, wow, life is a precious gift and people can be really bad and life itself should be grasped with both hands and love should be experienced and endured as long as possible and every day should be considered a gift. And you kind of want people who've started in those situations to just thrive. And it's really beautiful that that's what she'd managed to do. So we have this very humbling start for Honey. And then we have Barry, of course, who's this thrifty, insomniac workaholic who she meets. And you can imagine their mindsets are very different. And I would say Honey's got it right to some degree. She really enjoyed their wealth. She went on shopping trips with her sister. She went on ski holidays. People talked about her being this really warm, popular, likeable person. But I want to make it clear that this is not a woman who's a trophy wife. She was a very attractive woman, but that's not her place and position. That's not how she spent her time. You know, she married Barry in 1971. They had four children together, clearly very devoted mom. So they had a son, Jonathan, and three daughters, Lauren, Alex, and Kaylin. Now, whilst Barry was the moneymaker, you know, he was the one creating the incredible wealth, Honey worked really hard. She had her own projects. I mean, genuinely, this woman was devoted. And I would say it's her efforts that actually make them philanthropists in the eyes of many, many people. I mean, the couple donated millions and millions to charities, to schools, to hospitals. And Honey spent a lot of time devoting herself to charities, so she was on the board of multiple charities in Canada. So the Apotex Foundation in particular donated over $50 million worth of medicines to disaster zones. So she wants to see good happen in the world. And I guess, again, I'm just drawing from my kind of bias, I suppose, of thinking about how she started her life. But I can't help but not feel motivated to say that I think that came from what she endured and her parents genuinely endured in their own lives. You know, this is a woman who has seen the tragedy, the torment, and also witnessed the evil and wickedness of human beings. And she wants to address that balance and she wants to make sure that she leaves a mark that's positive in this world. So she's working in particular with lots of Jewish organizations. And Barry himself, he wasn't just doing what he was doing within the company. He was quite politically motivated. So he was a really prominent backer of the Liberal Party. And of course, that's led by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. I'm not going to say my personal feelings about Trudeau, because it's not appropriate. Anyway, it's Honey as well who finally persuades Barry to start really thinking about the future. Because, you know, they're getting on in years. And they've spent their lives devoted to the family, devoted to business, devoted to charity. And she really wants him to just enjoy it a little bit. So she's encouraging him to cut down on his work life and just focus on his kids and his grandchildren, and just to enjoy the winter of their lives. You know, they've made so much money, they've done so much good, but also they haven't necessarily had a great deal of time for each other, and it works. So Honey is persuasive enough and he decides that he's on board with her. So they decide to sell this multi-million dollar mansion and they decide to actually live a little. So they agree that they're going to create this luxurious $30 million complex and they're going to build it in Forest Hill. And that is one of Toronto's most prestigious neighbourhoods. So that last part and last chapter of their world together and lives together is going to be spent probably living how Honey would have liked to have lived, considering all the work that's been put in. So we get to mid-December 2017, and people who know Barry and Honey, they feel that there's a notable change. There's just something about the way they're behaving that is strange. It pricks their instincts and intuition. For example, Honey missed a charity board meeting without explanation, unheard of. This woman is devoted. If she's not going to turn up, there's going to be a reason and you're going to know about it. Totally out of character for her. She always attended meetings. She was known for her punctuality. And when she was actually asked later that evening if everything was okay, because clearly it provoked an immediate reaction, which is, this is not like Honey. And she simply said to them, look, I've just got some stuff to deal with. I suppose just for the purposes of balance, we could also say, well, you know what? It's not normal behaviour, but we all detract from normality at times. And it could just be that she hasn't been feeling very well. It could be that she's tired. She's not a young woman anymore. So that is possible. But the fact that she's saying that there's stuff to deal with, it does demonstrate that there's possibly a problem. Now, when it comes down to when she and Barry are last seen, this is on Wednesday, 13th of December, 2017. It's at the Apotex headquarters. It's around 5 p.m. And at this point, you know, they're looking over blueprints for this amazing property that they're building. They've got an architect, a home builder, and a subcontractor with them. So they're obviously making plans. And this is important to note, these are not individuals who are considering ending their lives in any way. So Honey leaves the meeting around 5:30 p.m. This is when she goes and sets off home. But Barry, true to his nature, because we know he's a workaholic, he continues working in the office for several hours. Now, the last contact that Honey is known to have had with anyone else was 6:21 p.m. that day. She had a 5-minute phone call with a friend. And the last known contact from Barry, if it was him, that's when he sends a single work-related email to his colleagues. Now, this is highly out of character for him. First of all, he's a really poor sleeper, a bit of an insomniac. So his tendency is that he works into the early hours and he's known for sending multiple emails. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think workaholics are very important to this world. But anybody else out there who's had those momentary experiences in the morning where you see a pile of information coming through from your boss, it always disconcerts you, doesn't it? Like, what have I done wrong? But this was very normal. Also makes you feel like I really can't turn down that overtime because he's been doing overtime for 50 years. Anyway, this is unusual. And what's even more telling and incredibly unusual is he doesn't actually show up for work the next day. This is on the 14th of December, 2017. This just does not happen. Now, the following day after that, it's Friday, the 15th of December, we've got real estate agent Elise Stern. Now, Elise Stern's job is, of course, to sell the mansion because they're going to move on to this incredible place that they're designing. So her job is to show around potential buyers. And obviously, we're talking about an elite sale. So they are going to individually handle it as a realtor, make sure that they do the best by the people they're selling the home for. But also, let's be honest, introduce new potential owners to the amazing world that they could have. That's their job. So she individually goes with this couple, uses the key to Sherman's home because it's been left for her in a lockbox to get in. Now, she didn't expect that Barry or Honey would actually be at home. She'd been advised that Barry was at work and also that Honey would be on holiday in Florida, where Barry was actually meant to join her a week later. So Elise takes the prospective buyers around the grounds. She shows them the tennis court through all these many rooms in the property. But before she leaves, she decides that she's going to show them the basement pool and the hot tub. You know, it's the pièce de résistance, isn't it? When you've been through an incredible home and then it's like, oh, hang on, let me show you the basement pool and the hot tub. In my home, it would be the sink and maybe the ensuite. That would be the selling point compared to what they've got. But anyway, this is what she does. So she takes them down, they enter the basement, turn on the lights, and she and the buyers in that moment kind of recoil in shock, but also they're a bit annoyed because they feel like somebody's taking the mick, basically. They feel like somebody's playing this really sick practical joke because their eyes are instantly drawn to two mannequins that have basically been tied by the necks to the handrail leading into the pool. Now, at this moment in time, they all kind of adjust to what they're seeing and think, oh, this is just some kind of sick Halloween display that's just been left over. So it looks like a fake murder scene. That's what they actually described it as later on. That's how it looked. It's interesting, isn't it? When you are presented with traumatic material that you're not used to, our brain does a lot to try to protect us from it. So it will almost parody the reality of what's happening to try to make us cope more easily with it. And this is exactly what goes on in the brains of those individuals. So Elise starts to approach a little bit closer because obviously she needs to show them around. She's just hoping to excuse this. Please don't let this stop them putting an offer in. That's what any realtor's going to be like. But as she gets there, to her absolute horror, she realizes they are actually people. And again, her brain just kicks into gear. Okay, there's a rational explanation for this. Maybe they're doing some weird kind of strange yoga routine. And I can completely appreciate that. Literally the other day, I was looking at pictures of goat yoga. And no, I don't mean that a goat was doing downward dog or child pose. I mean, there were people doing those things and goats were climbing on them. Not sure who thought of it, but I do love a goat. But anyway, that's what happens to her brain. So at this moment in time, she kind of approaches. She's thinking this is just kind of some weird thing going down, a little bit embarrassing. Somebody's doing yoga in a weird way. And then she realizes, oh my God, no. These aren't mannequins. This certainly is not yoga. And most importantly, this is not a fake murder scene. It's the bodies of Barry and Honey Sherman. They're both in this semi-seated position, side by side, with the legs out in front of them, and both had leather belts wrapped around their necks, knotted to the pool railing. And of course, that means that their bodies were being held upright. Now, judging from the scene before her, she was immediately aware these two are definitely victims of a double homicide. It was just obvious to her. Just bear that in mind. She's a real estate agent. She is not qualified in forensics or crime scene investigation. She is not an officer of the law. And yet, instantly, just looking at it, I've just got my eyes, just going to look at it. She could see this is a double homicide. Bear in mind, I am going somewhere with this particular line of thought, guys. So she immediately calls 911. This is at 11:45 a.m. and she is screaming to the dispatcher, they're dead. And I have total empathy and sympathy for her because no one expects to walk into that. I'm sure it stained her conscience and will do for the rest of her life. I'm sure it haunts her nightmares. So the police, well, they're there relatively quickly on the scene and they establish, as far as they're concerned, there's no signs of forced entry. Also, they think from assessing what's gone on that it looks like Honey had struggled with her attacker. So her body was actually in a pool of blood. Also, she had a bruise on her face. She had cuts on her lip and her nose, but there was very little blood on her actual upper body, and that would be because she probably bled out while she was laid face down on the tiled floor, and then at some point she's been tied to the railing by her neck, which was about a meter high. Now, both of the bodies are fully clothed, and also their coats had been pulled down over the shoulders. And of course, if you think about that, that kind of works as something that restrains you. You know, you can't move, it's tight over you. Now, immediately, that does not sound contextual with the murder scenes that I've often described. First of all, I think very few people would even know how to restrain somebody with their coats in that way. I mean, we all know that a zip will lock in a certain position. So if you restrain somebody that way, it's very hard for them to move out of it. But it isn't the first thought that you would have when it comes down to restraining anyone. I would imagine that you'd need to know that you could use that kind of an item to cause that kind of restraint. Otherwise, you'd be looking for things like ligatures and you'd be looking for things like ropes. So then the officers speak to Sherman's housekeeper, personal trainer, and also a furnace technician. All three of them had been in the property earlier that day, but none of them had actually been down into the basement because obviously they had no reason to do that. So the housekeeper and the personal trainer, they'd arrived first about 8:30 a.m. in the morning, and they actually noted that they were really surprised the alarm was not on. That was not typical behavior. It was always on in the past. Also, one of the things that really struck out for the housekeeper was that she couldn't quite believe that Honey had been found in the basement. Because according to her, Honey literally never went down there. She had quite bad legs, so it was difficult for her to get to the basement, and she chose not to go. So for her to be there, that's very out of place. So the police investigation that follows, well, when I describe it, you will not be surprised to know that it's been heavily criticised. Severely criticised, I could even say. So first of all, I don't know about you guys. I'm just going to throw it out there. That if you're a lead investigator of a potential double homicide, what you're going to do is lead. Yes. Are you the lead investigator? I am the lead investigator. What is your job? My job is to lead the investigation. And how do you do that? I stay in my office for several days before doing very much at all. I'm not sure that defines leading. It's maybe leading by example when it comes down to severely messing up a case, throwing it in there. Anyway, genuinely that happened. Didn't even attend the property until several days after the bodies had been found. And I've looked them up and they're not a psychic. They haven't got the X-Men ability to just like look into the future. Or I don't know, teleportate themselves disguised as a mouse and check out the scene quietly and privately. No, this is just somebody that didn't get up and go and see the crime scene. Not very effective. Also, apparently there's a delay in looking for fingerprints and other forensic evidence. Is it just me? Like, I don't need any experience in this field. If you put me in charge of that double homicide, potentially that double homicide at least, you would immediately know as a layperson, right, where are the people with the important dust stuff? Yeah, get all that bit and bob. Secure the scene. Let's do all that kind of stuff that I've seen on, you know, crime scene investigation and forensic files. Let's do that. Let's just do that. I've got no experience, but I'm here now, so let's do that. Yeah, they didn't get the memo. So they just like leave it. And that's catastrophic because the longer you leave a scene, the more problematic behaviour you're going to have around that scene, the more contamination you'll have, and the less obvious collateral you'll be able to gain from that situation regarding what happened to the victims. Now, early into the investigation, this is bizarre. For reasons that I cannot even begin to imagine, and I could not find definitively out, the police... Well, actually, I've just said, haven't I? You know, they had a lead investigator who didn't turn up. Maybe that's the problem. But the police, genuinely, suspect it's a murder-suicide. You know, the realtor who comes round to show people who are prospective buyers the home, she had it sorted. Double homicide. Obvious. Why? You know, both tied up by the necks, posed in strange positions. Just going to throw it out there. Not typical for somebody who murders their wife and then kills themselves. It's not the way it works, ever. But hey, that doesn't stop the Canadian police in this moment. They decide, yeah, it's a murder-suicide. And why? Because they believe that Barry had killed Honey before killing himself because Honey had injuries whilst Barry did not. Sorry. Like anybody with even an ounce of common sense would be like, well, there were no signs of entry. So could it be that Honey was badly assaulted and dragged into the home before Barry, who didn't come home, admittedly, as we know from his work experience, that he would not be around for several hours, that they could have had her, harmed her, and then used her as collateral to get Barry to do whatever he needed to do when he arrived. Just simple mathematics when it comes down to these kind of investigations. But again, didn't get the memo. Maybe the lead investigator was sat in the office eating donuts. I don't know why I said that, but whenever I watch movies of Canadian or American police, there's always some kind of donut involved at some point. And it sticks to me because donuts are delicious. But basically, this is really bad because one, they are wasting time. Secondly, they're losing key evidence potentially. And most importantly, they are now suggesting a man who's been devoted to his wife has murdered her. Can you imagine how the family would feel? They even went so far as to release this information to the press. That would be devastating. Devastating to the friends and family of the Shermans. You know, the couple had been married for over 40 years. There had literally been not one incident of violence. And again, when you just think about the behaviours of each party, you know, he's a workaholic. Yes, he's sending cars back when they bought for him on his 50th birthday. But she's allowed to go and do, spend, be whoever she wants to be with her friends, family, etc. There are no issues. He doesn't have a resentful attitude towards her. He's not harbouring some internalised rage that is kept hidden. And the family have to manage that their father's name is literally being placed in the press in such a diabolical way. Now, it also doesn't make sense that he would have committed some kind of murder-suicide because they were planning holidays, they're in the process of building their new home, they had literally just met with the subcontractors and architect to discuss that, and it must have been so distressing to an already horrendously distressing situation for the family. And they go ahead and end up releasing this statement expressing their feelings, and they said, "We are shocked and think it's irresponsible that police sources have reportedly advised the media of a theory which neither their friends, their family, or their colleagues believe to be true." So nobody who knew them thought this was possible. Bear in mind, even though the police had found no signs of forced entry, the reality is that, like me, the family felt that that didn't discount the fact that an intruder could have got in. I mean, in a range of ways. So the basement door to the house had been unlocked, apparently it often was. Also, there was a window that had been left open because they wanted to air a room after a paint job. And obviously, as I've noted, it could be possible that Honey was literally assaulted as she was outside the house and then dragged in. So there are all these theories that are equally as obvious, if not more obvious, than the things that the police are coming up with. Now, the family are obviously very wealthy. And this is helpful because they are so dissatisfied by the police investigation that they just think, we're not chancing it. You know, we need to know what's happened. So they hire private specialists, and this comprised of an experienced retired police detectives and also retired chief forensic pathologists. So they really get the big guns in. These are individuals with a great deal of weight. They want them to examine the crime scene. Also, very importantly, they want them to perform a second autopsy. And the pathologist is like, do I even need to do that? I mean, it's obvious that this is not a murder-suicide. Oh, I do. Okay, I'll do it. And it is obvious. It's absolutely obvious that both Barry and Honey had been murdered. And the autopsy's done, and the pathologist says, look, the cause of death was ligature neck compression. Also, he said, I don't think that Honey was killed in the basement. So, corroborating what the housekeeper said, I think that she was killed elsewhere. In the house, and then they dragged the body through the property and into the basement. And this theory is actually supported by the fact that her phone was found in the bathroom, and it was a bathroom that she never used. So her friends felt that this suggested that she was maybe trying to go in there and call for help, but she'd subsequently been overpowered. Also, the pathologist was able to identify marks on the wrists of both of the victims. So that indicates that at some point during the commission of the crime, maybe they've been restrained with cable ties. Also, the private investigators actually believed that the deaths might have occurred up to 36 hours before the bodies were found. So that would have been on Wednesday, the 13th of December. That's the last day that they'd actually been seen alive, because Honey's body, and bear in mind, this is a woman of means, she was actually wearing the same clothes that she'd worn that day. That is not typical of somebody like her. And also, from the morning of the 14th of December onwards, Honey had actually missed multiple calls, which again isn't like her. Now, this private investigation takes a while, and it ends in 2019, and it doesn't actually manage to identify a killer, but one of the things that it did conclude is that multiple people might have been involved in the murders. Now, what I would say about the horrendous police investigation initially, because it is, well, it changes around 6 weeks into the investigation. At this point, the police backtrack on their initial speculations because it's obvious they are all wrong. And they do concede that the Shermans had absolutely been the victims of a double homicide. I don't know, maybe they called Elise, the realtor, and were like, what are your thoughts? Well, my thoughts are that they were definitely murdered. Oh, okay, we'll go with that. Genuinely, what is going on? This is awful. And I kind of make light of it. But what I'm really saying is There is a family who has just gone through the worst losses most of us could ever even begin to contemplate. You know, these are individuals who've lost a mother and a father in the most brutal of ways, and the police have basically been blaming the father and ignoring the obvious signs that this is a double homicide. And fortunately, at this point, they decide that they're going to, you know, publicly announce that it was a targeted attack. And that isn't going to stop the reputational damage that's occurred, because people think there's no smoke without fire. They said it was a murder-suicide. It could still be that Barry had killed Honey. So you can imagine that they're dealing with all of that whilst grieving horrendously. And by this point, so much time's been lost. And when you lose time in an investigation, you lose crucial evidence. You lose things like witness testimony, because the more time passes, the less likely you are to reflect and remember something that you saw that was strange. If it's just after something plays out and you're knocking on doors and doing interviews, you've got a lot more opportunity for somebody to be like, oh yeah, there's a really strange looking person or persons around here the other day. You know, it pricks that conscience. The more time you leave, the more time you lose, the more evidence you lose. Now, from that point, even though we've lost all this evidence and the delays have been catastrophic, in my opinion, to this investigation, what followed would prove to be the highest profile homicide investigation, literally, in Toronto's history. So it's massive. And we have to also note that that's partly, if not mostly, down to the fact that the family are pushing this and pushing this. They will not lie until they find the killers of their parents. Now, several days after the discovery of the bodies, one of Honey's expensive pearl earrings is actually found outside the property in the gutter at the end of the driveway, which absolutely plays into my thoughts about how this played out. So the TV crew, who are kind of obviously following the case, they spot it. And they're the ones who actually alert the private investigators, because the TV crew were probably thinking, could call the police. Probably just going to go for the private investigators who, I don't know, seem to actually know what they're doing. But this is really important because, first of all, with respect to the police, it wasn't easy to find because, first of all, it had been covered in the snow and the leaves and therefore it wasn't easy to spot. But, you know, if you're doing a fingertip search, which you should be doing when there's a potential double homicide, you're going to find that stuff. You don't leave it for a TV crew to just find it. Because again, that's going to be a problem with contamination of evidence potentially. But what that does immediately is it presents that possibility I was talking about, that maybe Honey was actually ambushed outside the property and then she's forced to let the attackers into the property, meaning that the earring became loose in a struggle. And you can absolutely imagine that that would make sense. That's why there's no broken entry, so to speak. So the private investigators hand over their evidence, aka actual evidence, to the police. But despite countless interviews, despite loads of follow-ups of tips and examination of CCTV, they don't actually identify any suspects. And that means that literally months and actually years pass and no one's brought to justice. Now, 4 years after the murders, what the police do make public is CCTV of a man that they wanted to identify. Can we just all take a sharp inhalation of breath? Because I did just say that. The police, 4 years after the murder, 4 years, I don't know, anyone may think the police were literally trying to mess this up. Genuinely. I actually have some reservations about why this case was dealt with so badly. I'm not going to say that I believe I'm correct. I'd love to have your opinions on whether you suspect that maybe there are some reasons why the right amount of time, care, and attention was spent on this case, or why, shall we say, the right amount of time, care, and attention was avoided on this case. But I find this really strange, because what the hell is happening that we have all of those initial mistakes that are huge, but then we're releasing CCTV of a man that they want to identify 4 years down the line, 4 years, captured by a security camera at a neighboring house. Like, you wouldn't have had access to that 4 years ago. And basically, this CCTV shows a man dressed in dark clothing, and they said that he had an unusual gait. And that really does prick our attention. When somebody doesn't walk in a way that's typical, we notice it more. So he's actually walking on a street in the vicinity of the Sherman's home around the time it's suspected the killings have occurred. What on earth did they wait 4 years for to release that? I mean, literally, that crucial piece of evidence was available to the public at the time of the killings. I mean, at that point, all of this would have been fresh in people's minds. So they've waited 4 years and they're just hoping that somebody's gonna be like, oh yeah, I remember embedding the memory of the man with the weird gait in my mind and thinking about what he looked like, dressed like, acted like. Yeah, I remember that now, 4 years later. Come on, come on. It's unsurprising they haven't found who that is, because it's years down the line. And like I said, there are so many mistakes. You could almost suggest that whoever was in charge was making them on purpose. Now, one of the most unfortunate things about this crime, aside from the horrific loss of two human beings, is the impact that it's had on the remaining Sherman family members. I think that when you don't get resolved, you're always going to have suspicion. It's caused a rift between two of the children. So the daughter, Alex, she made public her belief that her brother, Jonathan, may have actually been involved in the commission of the crime. Now, the reason that she has this mindset is because 2 weeks before the killings, Barry had actually requested a repayment of a $50 million loan that he'd made to Jonathan's storage business. Apparently, Barry was having some temporary cash flow issues and wanted the money back. So Alex implied that rather than repay back the loan, Jonathan had decided that he'd have his parents killed. Now, that's a big accusation, and it would, without a doubt, be incredibly painful to be accused of that. Jonathan vehemently denied any involvement whatsoever, and he said that he would never dream of killing his parents just because they wanted a loan repaid. He said he was really close to his father, and that was both closeness on a professional and a personal level. And also, he went on to say, look, if this had been about money, the reality is that my dad planned to invest in my business again once the cash flow had improved. Now, since that allegation, Jonathan and Alex don't have a relationship. And I actually empathise with both sides. I really do. I think that finance is one of those things that does motivate people to kill. And I think that Alex is trying to find answers, and she's pointing the finger at Jonathan because it's a direction that to her makes sense. But equally, you can imagine, can't you, being the child in this scenario and being accused of killing your parents who you love. That in itself is terrifying to experience. It's that sense of reputational harm. And of course, when people are like, well, he did owe him $50 million, you can understand that that makes people often assume that you are guilty when you are indeed not. Also, the finger of accusation hasn't ended there familiarly. So the finger of blame's been pointed at four of Barry's cousins. Now, Barry was very generous. He'd always financially provided for those cousins, but they had never viewed this as like a really altruistic act on.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Barry's part. They didn't think he was doing this because he cared for them. They felt it was more of a form of coercive control. So the cousins, it turns out, had always felt that they were entitled to a share in Barry's business. They claimed that Apotex was actually a successor company of their father's business, and that Barry had basically failed to make them aware of an option agreement. So an option agreement is where you can essentially get a supposed share in a company if it's agreed in the contracts, and that could have given them a 5% stake in Apotex, which is obviously really lucrative when you're talking about a successful business. So ultimately, they end up taking legal action against Barry. So in the months leading up to Barry's death, they'd been embroiled in litigation. And that litigation case was actually dismissed by a judge. And after that case was dismissed, Barry had actually withdrawn millions in financial support to the cousins. So you can imagine that they're initially getting looked after and sustained by him. They then get angry because they think maybe they should have had more. And the consequence is that he ends up going, well, you're not actually going to have any more money from me. That is going to be very upsetting. Also, they apparently owed him $300,000 in legal costs. And a lot of people felt, well, that gives them adequate motive to kill him. But, you know, the stretch of losing the legal battle for financial assistance versus becoming an individual who's involved in wanting to murder two individuals, that doesn't, as far as I'm concerned, necessarily ring true. Because, of course, they're not going to be benefiting from the will. They're not going to be individuals who are going to have some lucrative reality after the death of these two. And they could definitely be looking at very lengthy sentences for the rest of their lives in prison. But again, we always talk about the two main motivators in murder are love or money. And sometimes it can be a mix of both. Now, unsurprisingly, there is another theory, and that is that Barry and Honey were killed as a direct result of Barry's, shall we say, questionable business behaviour. I'm not criticising him because I don't think there's any ethical behaviour in the pharmaceutical companies that are out there at all. I think it's the most corrupt organisations ever. And actually, he was giving people cheaper drugs. And therefore, he, in my opinion, has a higher reputational standing than those who are trying to squeeze the last pennies out of individuals who can't afford to pay for their own care. But people were angry with him. He was breaking the protocol of how you work with patents. So the belief is potentially that he had too many enemies, just got on the wrong side of the wrong pharmaceutical company who hired a hitman to kill him and to kill his wife. And Barry actually stated once, for $1,000 paid to the right person, you can probably get someone killed. Perhaps I'm surprised that that hasn't happened. And again, some people hate to imagine that big corporations would ever do that, but big corporations definitely do that. Governments do that. People who get in the way of certain things can find themselves, well, disappearing. And it's not something that is talked about as openly. Often it's almost impossible to bring individuals who hire these individuals to justice because it's so dark and they're so educated in how to do this. And let's remember, I've covered cases where people have been hired to be hit people. And the reason I cover them is because they're useless, because, you know, you can't spend $1,000 and actually get somebody to do a good job. You can't. But you can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars and get a professional. And they exist. It's as simple as that. Now, others have gone on and said, okay, we think it's a disgruntled employee, because in the months leading up to the killings, Apotex had actually lost a $500 million drug patent court case. And because of that, lots of staff have been laid off. I think that's a really weak suggestion. I just don't believe that people have not experienced and endured loss in their lives before and ended up just having to realise that it's par for the course and you're going to get another job. I mean, the brutality of the murders that we've talked about, it feels personal to some degree. And I'm not saying it's personal because it's a relational experience with a family member. I'm saying it's personal. Somebody does not like the way that they have acted and what's a message sent out there, the way that they were killed, the way that they were posed, the way that they were restrained. All of these things are a very clear message. It's a don't mess with us message. And it's terrifying to imagine that kind of message being sent by whoever sent it to whoever it was going out to. Now, Honey's sister, Mary Shetman, she's always believed that the motive for killing was actually religious. Now, apparently, Sherman had some really outspoken support for Israel, and she believed that that posing of the bodies the way that they did, it was all about the killer making a statement. By the way, I absolutely agree. It was the killer making a statement. It was definitely somebody saying, I want to humiliate these corpses and I want you to see how brave I am and bold I am in the way that I've done that. It's a power and domination statement as much as anything else. Now, it's more than 5 years since the murders and the police do not seem to be any closer whatsoever to solving it. Can you believe that? Can you believe it? Even though their own children put forward private investigators to try to tidy up some of the mess they created. Now, the family initially offered $10 million. That's right. $10 million reward for anyone with any information that could help catch the killer. As of 2023, they're more desperate than ever, and they've increased that to $35 million. This is a family that are absolutely desperate for closure. And of course, more than anything, they want the parents' killers to be brought to justice. They want legacy for their parents. They don't want to live with this horrific crime hanging over their heads. And it's really upsetting to imagine the fragmentation of this family. I kind of really hope that over time, people realize they were acting from a place of love when they were doing things like spurlessly accusing one another of doing horrible things. That actually that's down to the frustration of the fact that nobody's been caught and it's just a projection of unmanageable grief. Because it's awful to imagine that this family has fallen apart. Particularly when you think about Honey and Barry and their ideas for that future with the £30 million complex. It was probably all about the children and the grandchildren. And if they were looking down and seeing the mess that the innocent parties within this have endured and experienced, I just think it would make them so incredibly sad. I really do. When you think about somebody like Honey, who spent her life trying to really devote herself to charitable causes and to understand the motivations behind people and also to change the outcomes for people in marginalized communities, to think that her own children don't have relationships because of this, it would just crucify her. It really would. Now, that $3.2 billion fortune I talked about earlier, that was divided amongst the four children. That's per Barry's will because he wanted to look after them equally. And they've actually gone on to sell the pharmaceutical business. Doesn't surprise me at all. It's a dirty business. If you can wash your hands of that and make your profit and move on and try to put that behind you, I think a lot of us would do the same. Also, they actually demolished the home where the killings occurred because it just must be the most triggering of realities. Seeing that exists, seeing that place that would once have been a sanctuary, a place of deep and joyful memories, becomes something so bastardized in comparison to that, torturing their memories, it makes perfect sense that they demolished it. But none of them can rest. None of them can rest whilst this killer is still at large. And it's really affected them psychologically because Alex and Jonathan, they now have 24/7 private security because they fear that they might get targeted next. It's such a shame that, you know, Barry and Honey didn't have that security, that they didn't want to incur those costs potentially. And I would imagine they didn't want to believe that they were ever under threat truly. But you just think, oh, if only they had that 24/7 private security. But for the children to feel that that's necessary for them, it means that they're dealing daily with the trauma. It means that it's a representation of their lives going from being beautiful to vulnerable. Now, to date, this case that I've talked about, it remains open. The investigations are continuing. So I guess what I would say is to every single one of you armchair detectives out there, and I know you are there, and I know that after I told you this case, you were going to be going online and checking this out. And I know that if you're in Canada, particularly Toronto, you may be really thinking about, wait a minute, this needs to get solved. The right perpetrators need to be brought to justice. This needs to be boxed off and closed off for this family who is suffering. So if you are able to crack this very complex case, let's be honest, aside from it ethically, morally, and legacy-wise being a very worthwhile endeavor, I mean, financially, it would also prove to be worth your while because there's still a $35 million reward just waiting to be claimed. Imagine getting your hands on that cash for doing something unbelievably positive, not just for the family, but for this world, to help bring the perpetrators of this horrendous crime to justice. I mean, that would be a reward worth gaining, wouldn't it?
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.